Hello, everyone. Welcome to our panel called Taking Municipal Wi-Fi Back. I'm really excited about moderating this panel. My name is Spencer Ante. I'm an editor at Business Week and author of a new book called Creative Capital, which I just gave a reading about earlier today. So,
awesome.
The subject of our panel is municipal Wi-Fi access in America and in the world, really. And we have a great group of folks here who are on the front lines working on this issue. And Esme Voss is here from MuniWireless.com, and Rich McKinnon, who's a local guy from Austin, who's the founder of Austin City Wireless and CEO of Less Networks, which is, I guess, the company that's helping to enable Austin City Wireless. And to my right is Salona Bonewald, who's from the League of Technical Voters, the founder of it, and she's working on a lot of political and technology issues, and this is just one of the things she's working on. And so we're going to, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions for about half an hour, and we'll hear from all the panelists, and then given that it's the Interactive Festival, we're gonna, you know, open it up, the mic, which is right over there. So please, if you have any questions, head over to the mic and fire away. So municipal wireless access is really a really important topic, you know, especially given that the United States is, you know, largest economic power in the world, but you know, in terms of broadband access, we're lagging behind the rest of the world in a lot of ways. And so I think that hopefully we'll try to find some answers to, you know, spreading internet access through city networks, and that maybe that will help our country catch up to the rest of the world. And so first question I wanted to ask everyone is, you know, just introduce yourself, explain what your group does, and give us your take on, you know, what's been the problem with municipal wireless access, and what are you doing to help, you know, disseminate it even further?
Okay, my name is Esme Voss. I'm the founder of MuniWireless.com. MuniWireless.com is a blog and a small publishing company that has conferences, webinars, seminars, and a quarterly magazine. And it talks about citywide wireless broadband networks all around the world. I started the blog in June 2003 because I wanted to give cities everywhere, one place on the internet to find out what other cities are doing in terms of setting up wireless broadband. And initially, I focused on Wi-Fi because that was, you know, it's unlicensed spectrum, but it's gone to the point where, especially in foreign countries, it's, when you say wireless broadband, it's a mix of Wi-Fi, WiMAX, and 3G. So although in the U.S. people are very focused on Wi-Fi, in reality, what I'm seeing in China, Japan, Philippines, Malaysia, and Latin America is a mix of these technologies. Where would we stand on Muni Wireless today? It's a problem of business models. It's not a problem really of demand, because when I was walking around Austin today with my business partner and doing another startup in Silicon Valley, first of all, he has an iPhone. I don't. I refuse to get an iPhone unless it has 3G, because I'm used to my Nokia N95, I'm from Amsterdam. But I spent a lot of time in San Francisco. I just want 3G, because in Europe, you know, that's what you get on these phones. So we were trying to look for a restaurant, an address, you know, Google Maps, using the, what is it, Edge Network now for AT&T. It was very slow. And then I said, well, I'll turn on the Wi-Fi and see if, you know, maybe Austin Wireless City or somebody's got some kind of Wi-Fi. Unfortunately, we were in the corner of West 5th and one of these streets, and there it was, Wi-Fi, and boom, very fast. And we were able to find the address of the restaurant, its address, and find it on a Google map. Now, that experience is what I've had many, many times in other countries, for example, in London and New York. As you know, I only have a prepaid card here, you know, T-Mobile, so I don't have a data plan in the U.S., but I do have a postpaid plan with Orange in the Netherlands, but I get whacked with roaming charges when I travel to Japan, when I travel outside the Netherlands, actually, which is frequent because the country is about that big, and you know, you step out 2 kilometers in somebody else's place, and there you go, roaming charges. So I do rely quite a bit on the Wi-Fi access on this phone, and many Americans and Germans who travel abroad, they all have the iPhone, rely on the Wi-Fi access so as not to get whacked with huge data charges. I'll give you an example of what the data charge is like. A friend of mine, Anina, who runs Anina.net, she's a fashion video blogger who now lives in Beijing. She got a 10,000 euro bill from Vodafone because she was video blogging a conference in Paris and uploading it to her Nokia Life blog. So all the, and the other thing, the other problem I noticed also with 3G, although the carriers don't want to really publicize it, is that they do price data very high because they don't want you to use it very much, because in fact there is a capacity problem. It's not that, you know, okay, they're greedy, we know that, but they're maybe greedy for a reason this time, and that there is a serious capacity problem with 3G networks, and everyone around you is doing data, even voice. I'll give an example with voice. So the Netherlands, you know, has pretty good cellular connections. It's not like here where you step somewhere and it's gone. I was just standing outside a concert hall in the middle of Amsterdam. You know, everyone's trying to SMS or call their friends. You know, where are you? Where are you? Well, network's dead. I mean, it's not a big concert hall. It can handle maybe 600 people. It's not one of these 10,000-person arenas. But you can imagine, it died. So what happens if you have, and now the iPhone, the iPod Touch are selling very well, and, you know, all these devices also like Nokia that have 3G and everyone's using data. What happens actually when the carriers, if they do, lower the price of the data plans? The European Union is trying to push all the carriers, as they did with last year, you know, where they lowered the voice roaming plans. Now they're trying to force the carriers to lower the price of their data roaming plans. So what happens? I'm using this example because I'm saying that there is congestion on the 3G networks, and everyone, a lot of people want Wi-Fi. The demand is there. The problem is the business model, and this is what's happened with Muni Wireless in the last 5 years. Is there's been this hype where everyone goes, oh, we're going to set up these networks. And when I started Muni Wireless, actually, 2003, 2004, there were a variety of models floating around. One was that the city would deploy a network, spend money for the network, it's a public infrastructure, and that they would allow other parties, third parties, be it ISPs or even carriers, to exploit that network and sell service to people. So the idea, the municipality would build the backbone, the wireless backbone and the wired backbone, and then allow private providers to supply service on top of that. That was one model. And then you had this other model come in where someone would just come in and build a network for free, and they would somehow monetize it with advertising. That was, I think, the most popular model because it did not require the municipalities to come up with their own funds. That model, in retrospect, has, you know, when you're looking back, you say, okay, that was wrong. But at that point in time, people were thinking that there would be enough people to get on the networks to make it viable for an advertising model to survive. Because for an ad model to survive, you need a lot of people on the network, just like television and radio and that kind of thing. And that's not come true yet. I'm not saying it will never come true, because when we have all these devices, that could happen, but it's not there now. The third thing that's happened, of course, is that the price of they initially thought the deployments would cost X, and it turns out it costs 2X or 3X, because they underestimated the number of access points they would need at street level, number one, to provide the kind of bandwidth that people want. And they also underestimated the amount of backhaul, you know, the fiber or the DSL backhaul you'd need to carry all that traffic. At some point, it's got to go into the ground, or it's got to go into some WiMAX connection somewhere, and they underestimated that. In some countries in Asia, they're using, and even Europe, they're using 3G as the backhaul. But again, that assumes there is a good 3G backhaul. In Asia and Eastern Europe, they're building WiMAX networks, you know, especially in rural areas. But they're also using it for backhaul for Wi-Fi networks. Example, in Italy, in rural areas, you have a WiMAX tower down here, you have one up there in the mountains, in the little village. So you send a WiMAX connection up, and you drop it down as Wi-Fi, because, by the way, most people do not have Wi-Fi cards here or in their laptops, so they still use WiMAX.
But before we get into the rest of the world, I think it would be a good time to bring in Rich here to talk about, you know, one local city and what you've seen and what, you know, problems you've encountered, what successes you've had. I think it would be good to hear from that.
Great. As your local Austin Wi-Fi representative, welcome to Austin, Texas, the freest wireless city in the world. I'm the founder of the Austin Wireless City Project. It's a nonprofit volunteer organization with the mission to improve the quality and availability of public free Wi-Fi. In Austin, we have about 100 managed hotspots in a coordinated network of hotspots where you register for a free account, and then you can use your username and password at any one of these 100 hotspots. The network was designed in case of political or financial disaster, All right. We designed it so that we could survive those kinds of crises. The reason why we needed to survive a political crisis is because then SBC, now AT&T, is a Texas company, and they have a vested interest in the way municipal wireless networks go. We wanted to build a network that would fulfill our mission, but at the same time not put a big target on our heads so that we would be legislated or sued out of business, which is often the way you go when you're dealing with phone companies. The other thing we needed to do was make ourselves financially resilient. In other words, needing no money. If you don't have any money, then it's not a big deal if day two you still don't have any money. Okay, so what we did is we created a business model where every node on the network was responsible for providing or covering their own costs. Every node had to carry its own weight. This is very different from a lot of the business models you see out there where there's typically a single payer, right? Where that buyer buys all the equipment, buys all the broadband at a choke point, and then they are responsible for maintaining the service. Sometimes it could be a municipal network, sometimes it could be a third-party private entity, other times it could be a nonprofit organization like ourselves, but we didn't go that route because then we would be under the funding gun every year, would be in constant, desperate grant writing process to make sure we can keep the money flowing to keep the network going. So by designing it for a financial crisis, by making sure that every network in the node was responsible for carrying their own weight, there was never the chance that we would run out of money. If a particular node went bankrupt, then we still had 99 other nodes. If a particular node burned down, we had 99 other nodes. If they went out of business, any of these things, we still have 99 other neighbors that are still alive. And you know, and this is not an original idea. I took this page out of the internet. The internet was designed to be resilient in case of an attack, that there wasn't one central point of failure that you could bomb and take down the whole internet, right? Each node is relatively independent and knows where its neighbors are. And that was that's how Austin Wireless was able to build itself. So let's talk a little bit briefly about some of the things that we've been experimenting with in Austin relative to the evolution of Wi-Fi. Now keep in mind, we started in the fall of 2002, which is sort of ancient history in Wi-Fi years. We have been experimenting recently with social networks. Since everybody on the network has an account, that means you have the ability to fill out a profile and also pull in links to your other online profiles and social networks that you've invested in. That gives you the ability to experiment with this co-working phenomenon that we've been hearing about. You know, if you think about it, we go to public places to work. That's one of the appeals of Wi-Fi, is to get out into public and work in public. And you go to a coffee shop or a restaurant, and there are people around you that you see all the time, but you don't really know who they are, but they're there. Well, that space is your virtual office place, and by default, those are your virtual office mates, right? So the social network that's built into this Wi-Fi network enables you in a very easy way, without violating your privacy or theirs, to break the ice. You can see, that's a graphic designer, that's an IP attorney, let's make a startup, right? Or this person's a musician, I need music for my website. It's a very easy way to make those contacts. You upload your pictures, that type of thing. So we've been playing with social networking. The other thing is this on topic?
Yeah. Okay. Just give one more example, and then
okay.
We'll talk.
The last example is advertising. We believe that Wi-Fi should be free to the end user. Clearly, I said the costs are borne by the venue, but there's also another way to bring more money into the network to even defer more of those costs, and that's advertising. The mobile advertising industry is still in its infancy. It's not at a place where they can fund any significantly sized network, all right? That's still a myth. Now, one of the things we're able to do with Wi-Fi networks is that we know exactly where every user is when they're on the network, because a hotspot typically has a physical address, right? And because the users are part of a social network, we also know a little bit about the volunteer demographic information that the users provide. And as a result, we can help mobile advertisers come up with some pretty well-defined audiences to target. And because the ads are relevant, the users don't mind them as much.
Thanks, Rich. That's really interesting. I wish I would have known about that before, because I've been paying $10 a day at the Double Cheese Suites for Wi-Fi access, which I haven't been too happy about. Salona, you know, one of the things I found interesting about your bio was that you lobbied against Southwestern Bell's ban on municipal Wi-Fi. Obviously, that's been touched upon a number of times here, that the carriers are seen as an impediment to rolling out Wi-Fi to the public. So what are you working on, and what have you learned?
Well, it's funny being on this panel. First of all, I feel like I'm the little guy because they've done so much work. And actually, one of the other things that I was commenting on is in the audience. I know that we have some people, once again, that have done way more than I have. And I actually worked with Adina Levin, who's sitting over there. I'm sure several, yeah. with the ACLU being a legislative liaison. And Adina kind of headed the whole thing up. And I was the Republican person, the person to go and talk to Republicans. And the thing that ended up being the most convincing piece that actually won us that was sitting down with Senator Frazier and the whole, and I also, my last name's kind of well known in Texas because we're all the football coaches. And one of the Republican senators knows my uncles and my grandpa. And so several of the small towns, Flatonia, which is 5 minutes away from my grandparents' ranch, was actually trying to establish their own Muni Wi-Fi system. And because of that, the Republicans actually squelched it in committee and didn't let that bill out of committee because of how it was going to affect small Texas towns. So I'm a big believer in social networking, in case you haven't picked that up about me. the reason that I'm here, I guess, is because of the fact that I have been running around proposing a business model, and that's how I got hooked up with the phone people and some of the Meraki people and the Austin group and such. It was basically born after I was in a conference, and we were hanging out talking, and San Francisco had just, like, you know, welched out and, you know, said they weren't going to do it. And we were talking about it, and it's like, well, what kind of business model would work? And I came up with a several step program that I told some of the, both the city CIO and some other state CTOs about. And they said, let's start working on this because it sounds like an interesting proposal. And basically what it was is, one of the things that I have this favorite hammer of mine, and it's called the Free and Open Source Social Network. And I honestly believe it's going to cure the internet ills. And I use it on everything. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is have this underlying architecture for this where people could come in and share the internet and be able to use it and not just being the centralized points like Rich is doing, but any of us. And that's when I discovered the phone model and started talking with them. But that wasn't a complete solution, you know, not just having the individual sharing. You can't get municipal buy-in from that, right? What's a city going to do? Nothing. And so then I looked at the business advertising model and having the business sponsorships for some of these fees. I'm like, all right, fine, we do the advertising. That's how we help our poor out-of-towners who get charged way too much money to get free internet access. And, hey, we get to advertise to them too. Awesome. Especially, I mean, here at South by Southwest, how many people would jump at controlling your browser for $2 a day and putting advertising on there? Oh, my God, tons of people. But it's still not... why would the Muni support it? And that's where the social network comes into play with a lot of community tools and doing things for Austin. Here in Austin especially, we're like the perfect place because, man, do we have some active neighborhoods. How many of y'all have been to Las Manitas? All right. Our neighborhood groups in action there. I mean, people have been trying to come in and bulldoze it and put up huge condos, and they're like, no. Our neighborhood groups in Austin are incredibly active. And so creating a lot of different tools for them, because like right now they're just basically Yahoo groups and such, and creating ways for them to do their social networking and to help build community on the east side and doing things of that nature. And then suddenly, bing, I've got, you know, municipal interest. And then going in and doing different things where we can go and put Wi-Fi over on the east side of town, which is the poorer side of town, and going and supplying computers and doing all that. So that way the city actually gets involved in regards to bridging that gap instead of actual infrastructure and supplying the basic infrastructure that you need to do the broadband. Instead, we're just using all the stuff that's there. You cannot go through this town, open up your laptop, and not see at least three Wi-Fi systems. I mean, you just can't. And so it's just kind of like, how do we do that? And how do we work with these user agreements that Time Warner has been making people sign? And that's where a lot of that play comes into, is working with those user agreements, but at the same time, getting the Wi-Fi access that we want, because that's all I really actually care about, is being able to open up my computer and get directions when I'm lost.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, the one thing that I've been hearing about over and over again is that, you know, that we have the technology works. It's not a technological problem per se. It's the business model that's really preventing us from getting, you know, Wi-Fi, you know, in a much higher level. So I'm just wondering, is there, you know, the U.S. is not seen as a leader in broadband. It's not even, it's seen even as a less of a leader in wireless broadband.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could each comment on maybe one example in another country. Maybe it's South Korea, I know, is a leader in wireless broadband, and just briefly explain, you know, what can we steal from those countries to, you know, improve our situation.
So the issue of wireless broadband is very much tied into the wired broadband, because when you are talking about Wi-Fi, and you have to put the traffic somewhere, it has to be a fiber network. What the U.S. isn't doing that the European Union is doing well, I believe, is that in the EU, the European Commissioner for Telecommunications, Viviane Reding, has put a proposal in the European Parliament to force, first of all of the carriers to open up their fiber and DSL networks to all competitors. It's called structural separation. That means that the carriers, from a certain point forward, if the European Parliament blesses her plan, will have to separate the businesses, the one that that owns the infrastructure, so all the cables under the ground, the fiber, and the business is actually delivering services, DSL services, to the consumers. When you have structural separation, what you've got then is a business that's not dependent on this and this, and it's open to all competitors, you know, including new startups, cable companies, or what have you. Structural separation, in my opinion, is the only way you're going to get competition on the second layer, which is the service providing layer. Because any person could come down and call SBC, which is an AT&T, and say, hey, I want to lease so much, you know, fiber, so much capacity. AT&T says, okay, sure, no problem. Because they don't have another business that's competing with that business, you see. All they care about is to lease out as much capacity for a good price to any service provider. And, you know, that's what the EU is doing, and I think that has to happen here at some point.
When I look to other cities for models, I look to Montreal, Berlin, and the suburbs of Barcelona. In Montreal, I saw a project very similar to ours, and as it turns out, it's because they admired us and copied us, and that's great. But they also then started doing things differently from the way we do them here, and that's very informative if you think about it, where someone, admires enough of what you're doing that's the basis of their next step, and then they do things a little differently because they disagreed with the way you do certain things, and it gives you a chance to live almost in two universes at the same time, the way you did it and the way you might do it if you had another chance to do it differently, right? And so that's what I really like about Montreal, and they did something with technology that we didn't do. Here we really relied on servers at each of our locations. They were PC-based servers. We were trying to save Pentium 1s and Pentium 2s from going to landfill. We thought we could give them another life by putting them into service as free Wi-Fi hotspot servers, and that really was a great way for us to get started. There, it was inexpensive gear, and we were keeping them out of the landfill as long as possible. What they did in Montreal is they went to these programmable Linksys routers that have Linux inside them, and they skipped the server route. And it actually ended up being a very elegant solution. It wasn't as green, so to speak, but in terms of making it easier to put into venues, it was easier to get a venue to adopt that model, because here in Austin, initially, you had to find space in your business to put one of these servers, and you needed to power it, and it takes more electricity. So in a sense, there is a green angle to the smaller electrical footprint. We have now borrowed back from Montreal, and we've gone to a serverless model as well. I look to Berlin for their mesh networking. All right, we hear in the United States of examples of Meraki and Phone, which is a Spanish company. Those are mesh networking technologies. They started in open source, and then when they got venture capitalized, they were hijacked, and the lawyers forced them to start filing patents, right? And then there are business models around it. So it's great technology that, in a way, got crippled by the venture process. in Berlin, they're still using the open source mesh networking technology there to great benefit. Now, I confess that the group that's using it there doesn't really respect the user agreements or the service agreements with the ISPs. They are freely, willfully meshing residential broadband service that they're not really allowed to do that with. Okay, again, that's more of a political business issue, not a technological issue. But the technology works there, and it works at far less cost. That's not even English, you know what I'm trying to say. Than you would expect when companies here try to sell mesh networking to municipalities, it's a lot more expensive, and that's because the municipalities don't realize that there's a less expensive, equally good solution that works in Berlin, and then in the suburbs of Barcelona, it's very interesting there. They have a telephone monopoly in the country, and it's Telefonica. And Telefonica has basically redlined the entire country outside of the major metropolitan areas. So they've got Madrid, they've got Barcelona, they got all the big cities. But out in the rural areas, much like we have in Texas, Flatonia, for example, there's no broadband. And why do they do that? It's not worth it for them to trench out there and put in the broadband. So you have these ancient villages that are drying up because they can't get broadband. So what's the solution? Are they supposed to shut down the village and move to Barcelona? Well, no, they don't want to do that. So they did very much what we had to do in Texas, was to enable these villages to help themselves, to bring broadband to themselves. So they developed a point-to-multipoint wireless solution, right? The key part of this, though, is goes back to what Esme said, which was the businesses and the governments that participate in this network, they basically built a gigantic wireless LAN, right, where everybody funds their own way, but much like we're doing in Austin, right? But it's a big LAN. Now, here's the catch, and this is what's really cool, and we haven't figured that out here yet, but Esme mentioned it, is just because you have access to the LAN doesn't mean you have access to the internet. It's divided. The LAN is the infrastructure. The internet is just one of many services that you can get on the infrastructure, right? If you think about it, two people playing a game on their laptop. I play a game on my laptop. She plays a game on her laptop. We connect them together. We're a LAN, or the service is the game. It's a gaming service, so to speak. If we're not plugged into the internet, neither one of us have internet access, but we're still a LAN. So think of a network like that in a city where you can still get on a high-speed network, do services that have nothing to do with the internet. The internet's a whole other service that you can arrange for. You can arrange with a library to get it for free, or you can arrange with an internet service provider to get out, but you divide the two. And in our mindset here in America, we've always thought they're the one and the same. Infrastructure plus service, and it's not. Okay? So I look to Spain for that technology and that mindset of dividing the two.
Take any good trips lately beyond Montreal or Berlin or Barcelona?
Well, actually, I do travel a fair amount, and I do have a person in the audience from New Zealand where they're playing with some of the Meraki stuff. So hopefully at some point he'll chime in. Mike. Hi, Mike. but yeah, I'm not as familiar in regards to a lot of those different aspects. But I do want to chime in a little bit on what Rich was just saying about the fact that by creating these networks, we can offer a lot of different services. Some of the different smaller towns, again, the grid solution, while in Austin, was way too expensive to integrate with security and the fire department and all those different kind of municipal services. Going in and creating those grid solutions in really small towns actually can be a fiscally conservative business model for them. In that, currently, how are they doing it? Well, they're doing radios, or they're doing some other kind of really low budget solution. And so sometimes for them, setting something up like the grid solution that Rich was just talking about, those other services can be things like the volunteer fire department and other resources like that. So even though it is a broken business model for large municipalities like San Francisco and Austin and New York and Philadelphia, I don't think it's something that should be entirely dismissed when it comes to some of the smaller towns.
I just want to ask one more question, and then we'll throw open to Q&A. Besides the business model, the other main thing that I've been hearing is this is a political issue. you know, to some extent, it's because the cities have tried to take it on their own shoulders and build these networks, and they haven't worked out so well. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the telecom companies have a lot of power. They have a lot of lobbyists. And I know that they've tried to pass laws banning cities from building these networks. And I'm just wondering, do any of you think there's a chance that we could build a political movement to promote Wi-Fi on a national level that could, you know, supersede the, you know, corporate interests?
Yes, you can. And I think the Texas movement to defeat that hideous bill a couple of years ago, I recall that, don't you, when SBC was trying to get something passed? Yeah, that one, you know, we played a very big part. Muni Wireless put out all, you know, get people together and everything. But I think to do that, you can't just talk about Wi-Fi as a technology or the infrastructure of broadband. You really have to tie it into needs. I mean, most people are walking down the street. You tell them, hey, we need Wi-Fi. Well, why? But if you explain to them that it's a question of having choice, of local communities building their own network to suit their own needs, people understand that. When you tell them it's to take back control from the big phone company that doesn't care about them because they're too busy making money in big cities, they understand that. You need to always go down and ask yourself, well, why do you need that kind of control in your broadband? Why do you need that kind of speed? Why do you need that kind of local management of your own broadband solution? Because unless you talk that way, most people will just walk right by you.
For me, my main thing is, and one reason why I'm doing the things the way that I'm doing them, is I want everyone addicted. I want everybody to be just as addicted as I am. Because when I went to New Zealand and stayed there for a month, I ended up spending over $250 on internet. And it just hurt. I have a nonprofit. I do not make much money. And spending that amount of money, and I kept complaining to Mike over and over again about that and talking about Austin, and in Austin we have this, and in Austin we have that, and in Austin we have this. He's like, you know what? I'm going to go set up my own grid. So the next time you come down, you'll sit there and see how awesome Wellington is because we've got this all set up. And I think getting people addicted to being able to just pull out their laptops, get on the map, go look for that sort of thing, having things like the iPhone and being able to switch off their phones onto the Wi-Fi locally and doing things of that nature is a really key component. And so getting all those small businesses with Rich's model where you're used to, well, I went to a coffee shop and they didn't have free Wi-Fi. How could that be? Is how we actually politically motivate people, is we get them addicted.
Great. Well, I see we have one question right there. I'm going to hand it over to you and then fire away.
Okay. Thank you for mentioning Montreal. I'm from Montreal, and we do have an interesting system, isn't it? So thanks. I have a question. I really believe in the advertising-driven model for Muni Wi-Fi or for free Wi-Fi, but I think the projects that have been introduced, they're missing an important component, and it's the local sales force. And I wonder, what do you think about partnering with Yellow Pages providers? We've got access to that sales force. They're talking to small and medium-sized businesses. They often have the ears of the telcos, even though most of the telcos have sold their Yellow Pages business, they're still friendly. So what do you think about that?
That's a great idea. Similarly, we've been talking to in Austin, it's called the Austin Chronicle. In San Francisco, it's called the SF Weekly or the Bay Guardian, the Village Voice in New York. Every city has a weekly newspaper that is completely subsidized by local businesses advertising. And you know, the challenge is aggregating those sales departments, sales teams, to bring those ads into the Wi-Fi space. But you know, it's very compelling if you think about it. I mean, the Austin Chronicle is about 200 pages every week. You buy an ad there, it may cost you $500, right? But it's on page 93, you know? I consider myself a reader of the Chronicle, but you'll be lucky if I happen to stumble across your ad on page 93, right? So it's a compelling value proposition to tell that advertiser, but you know what? We'll also run your ad across all the hotspots in the city, particularly the hotspots that are near your particular store, mm-hmm. right? So it's very compelling, but you know, the challenge is kind of reining in all of these resources like the ad sales of the different newspapers. Great idea, though.
And I'd like to chime in there again with my hammer. With the open, with having a social network in that you can start having the events and the real integration in regards to what your friends are doing and all that. And it's like such a huge value add for advertising. It would just be insane. I mean, like, I want to, there's so many parties that I miss that I really want to go to. So having something that integrates like that would be like pretty fabulous. And Austin with the Chronicle, we're all about the good time entertainment here, as y'all are probably all experiencing at South by Southwest. I'm sure all of y'all are tired now. I'm actually really glad that y'all all came out for a panel on the last day. Yay, you guys, man, y'all are hardcore.
Great. I actually have to go catch a flight back to New York, but I'm glad to see we have at least four more questions here. And so please come up and ask your question.
So two questions. The first for Esme or anybody else on the panel. Esme, you talked about the EU proposal to have structural separation, which sounds amazing, is totally the way to go. And I'm wondering whether you have or know people who've done networking in the US, and are there any serious supporters, you know, not just from us techno geeks, for structural separation here?
I have not heard of any, because the minute you, a politician here breathes the word structural separation, they're not going to get money from the telecom operators who are very big political contributors. It's that is a problem with American political life, is the issue of getting money for the funding for their campaigns.
Okay, and then the other question, very quickly. Rich, you mentioned social networking features associated with the LESS network system. Is that up and available or in earlier stages?
Yes, it is. It's up and available. Because half our network is still in Austin, most of the social networking is here, but we have hotspots as far away as Thailand and London. And again, what it does is it allows you to see who's logged in at other hotspots nearby or anywhere else in the network. In addition to the hotspot that you're in, you can look at their profiles or pictures, and you can send what we call shouts or whispers. A shout is a Twitter style message where you can say something that's displayed on a Google map with your picture and the location of your hotspot on the map, and the map kind of shoots back and forth as people shout back and forth. And then there's a whisper where you can essentially say something mm-hmm. private to people.
Thank you.
Have we been doing open data standards on that? Been looking at like open social and open ID for the data standards?
Well, we have been looking at...
Sorry.
we have been looking at open ID, and we're following it closely. The reason why we haven't done it yet is because our programming resources are so
tight,
so tight. And to be frank, while the people like us are on the edge and are aware of OpenID, 98% of the general public have no idea what you're talking about when it comes to OpenID. And you could actually confuse the login and registration process by giving them an OpenID option. So we're waiting a little bit longer for people to understand it. And when that's there, then we'll go ahead and implement it, because it is a great idea.
I'm Raj. I come from the mobile industry. I had a bunch of questions. I'm going to save some of them for after the panel, but I was hoping you could elaborate on what didn't work in Philly with their Muni Wi-Fi deployment. And then second, with respect to Mountain View, Google provides free Wi-Fi across the city, and I'm curious, like in the Austin model, you have the local establishments paying for Wi-Fi, but they have Wi-Fi access even in the parks. And so I'm curious, How is that going to be tackled?
Well, I don't work on the Philadelphia project, but my understanding of what happened there is similar to what happened elsewhere. That the party who was going to build it in the first place, Earthlink, decided they were going to get out of the municipal Wi-Fi business. Earthlink decided to get out of the business, not because of Muni Wi-Fi itself. They barely built anything, as you probably know. Never had a chance to test its viability over a number of years. Is that... Companies just, their CEO died a year ago, and he was a big backer of Muni Wi-Fi. And, you know, the new CEO just has to clamp down. So, and I think the project has a lot of cost overruns. So that's the other thing. So the big backer is gone, the cost overruns. And the other question?
The other question was related to Mountain View. The reason why Mountain View exists is because Google is in Mountain View, right? And if there's any project that has a chance to Wi-Fi project that has a chance to succeed because of advertising funding, it's got to be Google, right? They have the deep enough pockets. What worries me is that it's moving so slowly and it hasn't spread to other cities, even in the Bay Area, which leads me to believe that maybe, like I said, the mobile advertising market is still too immature. Let me give you an example. At one of ESME's conferences, there was a great panel on the different kinds of next generation services that can run across Wi-Fi, like social networking, right? We're trying to anticipate the future where internet access is just the basic. What can we do beyond internet access since we're all on the same network, right? So social networking is one of the obvious things. And you looked at the different entrepreneurs and their business models that were on this panel, and they were coming up with great ideas, but when you asked them how they plan to fund themselves, they all said, well, it's going to be through advertising, right? So being the ornery person that I was in the audience, I said, advertising, where are those dollars? Is there anybody in the audience who knows a single person that's writing checks today for advertising across a Wi-Fi network to fund Wi-Fi, let alone all these cool business models that are going to be dependent on advertising as well, right? As it turns out, there were a lot of finger pointing, but there were. I did meet three, and that really made for me the conference worthwhile. So I met three advertising partners there, and we've been piloting some of the best advertising programs today in Wi-Fi. So when you look at our ads here on Austin Wireless, you're seeing the state of the art in mobile advertising for a wireless network. Now here's a secret that most people don't realize. How many people if we have 200 hotspots in our network, right? We're doing 200 new users a day, and we're doing 50,000 connections a month, right? We know where you are when you're looking at the ads, okay? Just an estimate, someone in the audience, guess how much money we make a month in advertising. Raise a hand and I'll tell you higher or lower, just like Price is Right, there in the back. Lower. 1,000. Lower. Higher. Lower. $200 a month. Okay? That's the real market rate for advertising in the Wi-Fi network. And if you think about it, most hotspots in the world are free hotspots are standalone. They're not even affiliated or aggregated into an organization. When it comes to hotspots that are connected together and managed by an organization and the Wi-Fi is free, we're among the largest in the world, right? So we command the best ad rates, right? Now you know why the advertising model failed in those cities. $200 a month, that's $1 per hotspot a month, all right? So the thing is though, we do know that the mobile advertising market is going to mature and that there will be more money there. It's just they're not quite sure how much it's worth it to them, right? And that's the catch. So anyway, how did we do the parks in Austin? As I mentioned before, every node in the network is responsible for covering its own way. So 70% of our nodes are private sector, coffee shops, hotels, whatnot. The other 30% are controlled by various governmental agencies. So state of Texas is the capital, right? We have the public library system. We also have the Austin Public Parks Department, that's what covers that. And then we have the Regional Transit Authority takes care of the Wi-Fi in their property.
Yeah, and we do actually have it's slow, but we do actually have a mesh network in a lot of the parks here in Austin. It's COA mesh, City of Austin mesh. It's slow. Yeah, it's slow, but it was an experiment that the city did and wouldn't have happened actually without the legislation getting killed. But but the problem is they never were able to invest in it significantly because of the fact that they were never able to get any coverage in the buildings. And that was one of the problems with creating that mesh is how do you get coverage in the buildings to get the ubiquitousness that you actually need?
Okay, I'm Mike from New Zealand, so I thought I'd actually give what we're doing there. So since Solana mentioned us, the reason I've started an initiative called the FreeNet Aotearoa is that I actually see it as a nationwide competitive advantage, in the sense that every time a person sits in a cafe in Austin and gets an email, and a person in a cafe in Wellington says, "I'm going to wait till I get home because I don't have hotspot access here," or it's a provider that I don't have an account with, it's somebody else, we lose out, okay, because they go home, so it's 2 hours later. So in a competitive world, as a country, if we don't have real-time access to information to make decisions, we will fall further behind every day. The advantage of having free Wi-Fi is that once you get it in the sort of business sense, is that it spills over into the community. For example, a number of web design companies are very interested in sponsoring free Wi-Fi around their neighbourhood and their cafes for their staff, but they're also going to give the boxes to their staff to take home, because they just see it as a good thing to do, because they're all into open source and believing the internet is of value to everybody. So it permeates the community anyway. I agree with you about the marketing advertising model. We actually see there may be a future later on when we have sufficient volume to do an open source model with distributed control, where each person goes to a place, registers their device into the network, and has the ability to control advertising on their own node. So a cafe or a bookstore can put up free internet, and the model is that they can put their free ads up there as well. So a big thing with these devices and mesh networks is that they're now so low cost to buy that you can't afford to have people trying to sell advertising on them or have someone trying to manage it, because the cost of that management is more than the cost of the network. So you actually have to have a model where there is no management, it's self-managing in a distributed manner. And that's kind of a challenge for government or our government, our government agencies anyway, because anything that involves public funding requires management. And you can probably do the whole project for the cost of a single project manager. I guess the other point is that it's kind of a mind shift happening at the moment that this can be grassroots and top-down. So people are quite happy to go and buy a device and give away free internet access. Because in New Zealand, we have a different pricing model where you pay for a traffic volume per month. So like I buy 20 gigs a month. It runs about 10 megabits per second. And I use about 12 gigs, so I'm quite happy to give away 8 gigs. And most people are like that. They'll have 5 gigs spare or something like that. The cost is already paid by them, and all they're doing is donating the excess back to the community. So that's just the way our particular pricing structure works, to incentivise people to donate. And I think there's room for both the telcos and the free part. What we say to people is, this is a free network, it's open, there's no security on it, there's no guarantee of service. If I need that extra PowerPoint, I'll unplug it tomorrow and put my Christmas tree in. But if you start to like it, then perhaps you want to go to a paid service, and you'll actually suddenly find that it's worth $10 a month to you to pay for an internet account with a wireless ISP. But we're just demonstrating to you that the internet is of value. And I see the future in this, because of the amount of portable devices now happening. Laptops will diminish, I think, in the future. You'll have single function devices or handheld devices more often. So you're seeing the iTouch, the iPhone. There'll be more of those. And so people will get to this idea of walking down the main street and not wanting to have their session broken as they walk between the different nodes. So that's why we're going to be putting it in the first place down our central business district, so that visitors New Zealand and business people and office workers out in the lunchtime get the experience of this, and then we're hoping that it'll go out to the communities.
Thank you, Mike.
Hi, I'm John Durkin. I'm from Los Angeles, and a couple of people in LA sort of have gotten frustrated with the fact that, like the rest of our city, there's a lot of different ideas going on, but there's no unified anything going on in LA. But we are working on a thing called wifi.org out of Machine Project. And very much in the same line as the guy who just spoke, that's kind of our idea there, where it's totally decentralized. There's not a top-down control or management of the network. And the problem I have, or that I keep seeing, is that there's no easy, already sort of rolled up DDWRT plus maybe a wiki for your splash page that you can just easily install at your own site, like if you're a home user or a coffee shop user or something, or a coffee shop, and you want to have a free Wi-Fi hotspot for yourself. It would be cool if there was a version of DDWRT that was super easy to install that already went ahead and divided off part of your service for the free Wi-Fi, and then the rest of it is for you, and you can throttle it, and your part is secure and divided off of the part that you're sharing. And I think, like, I wander around Los Angeles. I was just in Mexico City, and I noticed the same thing. You will always see 8 to 15 Wi-Fi points all locked. People would share them if they knew they could. And I think that that's a big barrier, that there's not some easy thing for people to know that they can replace the OS on their Linksys router and start sharing their Wi-Fi and slowly create a bottom-up blanketing the entire city with free Wi-Fi. Over time, I mean, we're not planning to just, like, even start gridding it at all until, because it's so spread out, that the Wi-Fi points don't often overlap. So, you know, that's something I'd like to see happen if anybody's, or know if anybody's working on a real easy to download and go ahead and just deploy at home, at your coffee shop, or wherever, and start sharing. Really, it's just people need to know that they can share.
I think one of the hardest parts that, like, I have with what I've been talking to the different people about is the fact that you do have those Time Warner user agreements that people have signed, where technically when you do that, you're breaking the law. Not that I would ever
their policy.
Break the, well, yeah, sorry, breaking, yeah, it's not breaking the law, it's breaking policy. Neener, 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 come after me.
Yeah, I think that people don't care about that really, though.
Yeah,
I
mean, but municipals do, you know, a muni has to.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why I'm looking at all these different constructs, is so that we can get past that. But yeah, I'm all about people doing their own thing and doing something along those lines, and I think that would be awesome. But municipalities can't go that direction.
Right, that's why. And I see that Los Angeles is making, well, before all the money problems, they were considering deploying some kind of, you know, the mayor was talking about trying to do some kind of Wi-Fi on the transportation networks, which also need to be finished. I don't see that actually happening anymore. I mean, I it's just talk, and I don't think that anything's going to happen now that all these other places have tried it and failed. I think Los Angeles will probably stop talking about that.
Your vision for a fully organic wireless network resonates with me.
We're largely inspired by what you've done. I mean,
Thanks. And it's something that we considered carefully here. You know, before the Austin Wireless City project got started, we looked around and we saw that we already in town had 200 hotspots that had kind of grown up organically. And so what we had to decide was this a grassroots movement, or was this weeds? Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you see them in Los Angeles so much, but we have a lot of squirrels and birds here, and they will inadvertently plant trees for us. Right. We call them volunteers.
Yeah.
Right. And a volunteer tree is cool if it's growing in the part of your garden where you want it to be. You don't want to volunteer a tree under your house, for example. So our vision for our organic free wireless network was to have a planned network. I would be really afraid of my network where people just start unplugging them and plugging in Christmas trees, to be frank. Like, you know, I really get the sentiment that, you know, it's kind of ad hoc, but I really want something permanent. I want something permanent for the population of Austin. And that's what we mean by improving the quality and availability, because when something is purely grassroots like that, there is no quality. It's whatever the squirrels plant, so
yeah,
to speak, right? And they may not plant it where you want it, right? So there is sort of a careful balance between squirrels planting and then kind of gardening, right? Discouraging planting over here and encouraging planting over here, and there's gardening. So, you know, I also love the idea of management-less networks, right? And in fact, if you think about the company name, Less Networks, it comes from this philosophy of less, but it's not no networks. Because we're afraid that if you have nothing present to manage it and to kind of make sure that there's a gardener, we will have no networks, right? So the key is the difference between this, the extreme of zero management and the minimal management necessary to give us the quality that we're expecting that supersedes sort of a random network planted by squirrels.
Do you think, by the way, that if have you were you threatened with being sued at all? Because you weren't like, I mean, I wonder if we could provide the rolled up thing I'm talking about, where each hotspot gets a wiki page that pops up that's their own, that the users who log on at that location, they see that splash page and they can, you know, update it too, and like a bulletin board.
Yeah,
like a community.
But, you know, if you want, you can download the software that we use at the Austin Wireless City Project. It's available on SourceForge and FreeMeet. And it does everything you want. It's actually better than a wiki, because wikis can be defaced, and that is management. You're going to have someone there monitor the wiki, right?
Well, I figured each individual would monitor their own wiki and make it more or less editable, depending on if they want it
That means graffitied every, that's right. That's right. You know. So that anyway, you can download the stuff, and even though it's centrally managed, it doesn't cost anything for the venue to use our central authentication servers.
Well, the thing that concerns me is if we offered that, like a similar thing, like you download it, it helps you register with our network and provides you with the wiki and instructions and stuff, would we be in danger of being sued by a telecom for almost encouraging people to, you know, like you said, violate their user agreements?
They probably won't see you, but if you're encouraging people to violate the terms of use for residential broadband, you can put yourself on the wrong side of them. But if you work with them, they can actually help sponsor your movement. Like in Austin, Time Warner provides the window stickers and the table tents that tell you how to use the Austin Wireless City Project.
Yeah, I figure they're going to end up getting more business, not less.
Exactly. Less, you said less.
Next, we have 5 minutes, so the next questioners should make the question short and sweet, please.
My name is Frank. I live out in the country, and I'm on dial-up. And 4 miles from my house, if you're on the highway, you can get cable, broadband, so forth. And I guess my question is, how... You know, I appreciate the fact that Austin has a great network and all that, but if I want to stay home on a rainy day and work and use my broadband connection, and of course that won't work with satellite, which is the only thing I can get, what kind of steps can I take to see that I can get a broadband Wi-Fi hotspot somewhere near my house, a mesh network, and those sorts of things, and get it closer to my house?
Okay, so that's collective action. You probably won't be able to do it by yourself, but if you find some compadres to help you out, you can do it. It's what I was talking about in the suburbs of Barcelona, okay? So basically, you become a WISP, a wireless ISP, like a co-op. Right. If you think about the way the Texas electrical utilities were original co-ops, right, you would create a co-op for your, we'll call it a village, and you will share in the broadband. There's a trench that's going to have to be dug out to you, and that's expensive, like $10,000 or more, right? But if you share that cost among several people in the group, right, and then charge co-op fees, like grocery stores are co-ops, right, membership fees. Once you have the broadband coming to a single point, you can use a mesh network to distribute it around your village. But, you know, it's an effort. And guess what? This is what we're doing in Africa, right? I mean, you can't go dig trenches all throughout Africa. It has to go through wireless, because the telephone companies don't want to build cell phone networks to poor villages. There's no one to subscribe, right? So it's folks in our movement, they're going to the, you're in the same position as the third world. Right, and so it's a third world solution for you, and it's tough, but there is an answer. Okay.
And I think like actually the Kiwis went and had something just like that, where there was like some guy who like couldn't get anything, and so y'all just like created a direct beam over to him so that he could actually get the internet access. Do you know what I'm talking about, Mike? It's on one of the user groups. They just like set it up and beamed it to him. Which was awesome, but you know, Kiwis are all kind of like, you know, hey, we'll take care of it ourselves. So,
one last question, and yeah. Those who have not had their questions answered can just come up to us after the panel.
Yeah. So, since I'm last, I'll add a little bit of levity. I work with rural telcos, both the co-ops, municipals, as well as what some people would call a a membership. These are typically regulated by electrical oriented boards that made it possible for these people to connect in the first place. This guy had bulls, this guy had wheat or hay, and they needed to talk about it. And they didn't necessarily start with talking over barbed wire, but eventually that facilitated putting in a switchboard, and yay, verily, someone becomes a telephone company one day. So the fella over here, I don't know how far you are out there, but it's harder to create one now, and when you guys pay your phone bills, if you actually have an access line, which I hope you don't, at the bottom of it, there's probably something called the Universal Service Fund. And that's government money that flows back into these small rural environments so they can actually create the communication networks that we take for granted. So, the moment of levity. It's one of my friends in Raleigh, North Carolina, not necessarily as big as Austin, but he's at one of the more popular hotspot areas in the emerging South Glenwood District, which is very highfalutin. Working at Helios, spotty Wi-Fi again, damn internet. And that's his Twitter update. So even in the best of the most vaulted, technologically oriented communities, you're still going to have these issues. So one of my questions is, in the rural communities where someone tries to come out and tries to build out and get cable programming or any type of program where they're going to overbuild into a community, what would some of the panelists say as far as putting stipulations if you're going to have like a town board meeting? What should you be including in the boilerplate so that you can have that, and not use the word structural, just avoid that. You give it a name like the don't kick puppies clause, and who's gonna disagree with the don't kick puppies clause? But how can you get community-oriented networking built in when an overbuilder is gonna come in? So.
I have an answer. So we actually did that in Austin, and it was a group of city stakeholders, private sector, public sector coming together, trying to figure out what would the ideal ISP, cable company, telephone company look like if we could create one. We wanted to create more diversity in the marketplace. We had SBC and we had Time Warner. If we added a third player to the market, maybe we'll get better competition. So the best brains that we had in the region came up with a business model, and everyone thought this was great. And so then they said, all right, we've got a business model. Who wants to go and be the business? Who can get the funding to be the business? That became what's called Grande Communications here in Central Texas. The clauses that you're looking for are in that business model, all right? The sad note is Grande is suffering because some of the clauses that were in there that helped them not kick the puppy, so to speak, made them less competitive with Time Warner and AT&T. And so they were forced to build in great areas where those other companies wouldn't dare build because there's no market, but they were forced to build there first. So they were losing money for years building in places to provide service to communities are you with me? So it's like the opposite of redlining. They were forced to go where no one else wanted to go first, and now they're not financially strong enough to actually go into the more affluent neighborhoods. That's right. So if you check their business model, you'll see a great model created by good people, but it's just difficult if you're competing against those other companies.
Yeah, and I was like totally pissed off because I lived in an affluent neighborhood and I couldn't get Grande because I wanted to support them and I wanted to have their model, but then they weren't in, you know, the yuppie area that I was living in, which sucked. So, yeah.
So, thank you, everyone. If you have questions, just come up.